how are news organizations doing with their own historic materials as repositories of the first draft of history? How thorough a job are news archivists doing at retaining their digital legacy? In this era of dwindling budgets, what are the biggest challenges and constraints facing them in this task? Our speaker, Vicki McCarter, is formerly senior editor of the Los Angeles Times, an adjunct professor at the UCLA Department of Information Studies, and one of the principal founders of a digital assets management consultancy, which I will cop to, I'm the other partner. She will present the results of the inaugural 2005 survey of NewsLib members and discuss trends she'll be watching, including threats, opportunities, and emerging best practices. The survey was done under the auspices of Inter Pares, the International Digital Preservation Project. Vicki McCarter.
I apologize for the title if it offends anybody. But at this hour of the morning, we've got to try everything we can. And actually, I think that's probably the biggest problem with digital preservation for newspapers is they always hold my sessions at 7 and 7:30 in the morning. So thank you very much for being here. Let me see a show of hands. Who's not from the news division? Oh, wow. Okay. Dude, that's great. I'm from L.A.
You know, in all fairness, that's cool.
And then... and then let's see who is from the news division. You can hold up two hands if you want. Okay, great. So as I go through this, I'll have to explain what is going on, which obviously is the case anyway. We decided to undertake a survey of news archives for two reasons. One is there's still an awful lot of education that has to go on here. I would say that the learning curve on digital preservation is still pretty much vertical. Would anybody disagree with that? The other thing is I think it's an important time to try to benchmark what's going on. And as I continue down this primrose path with Peter, we would like to do this survey again in two or three years and just see as we go over what the threat to this content continues to be. I hope you all ate breakfast because you're going to see about 13 different pies. And so if you're hungry, a lot of pie this morning. We'll try to keep it entertaining. The survey itself was done online August and September of last year. We subjected these poor people to about 80 questions. And a lot of them died along the way. The survey takers sort of collapsed at about question 40. So we might have started out in the high 70s, and all the way at the end, we were maybe in the 40s or 50s, people taking the survey. Some of that, I think, is just survey fatigue. Some of it, I think, is as the questions got more complicated about digital preservation, people just didn't know how to answer them. So that's the education component. What we'll do as we go through these questions is I'll review what the question was, see how news libraries answered, and then try to explain the context of why I think the question's important. And then I'll blab for about an hour, I guess, and then we'll take questions and you can come up afterwards and all that. So without further ado, let's see if we can hang on to our assets. One of the questions we asked was, what do you think the big issues are in digital preservation if you're at a news library? And this answer seemed to be a really, like so many of the answers, it seemed to sum up everything that's going on. In the pursuit of the bottom line, management seems to feel that it is more important to spend money on getting the paper out today than it is to archive for the future. And that is absolutely the case. And it's not a situation that's getting any better. It's actually getting worse because news libraries are really under siege as far as hanging on to existing jobs, having any kind of budget to do any of this kind of work. And lest anybody be misled, digital preservation is very, very expensive and much on a factor of magnitude more expensive than keeping paper. And with so many commitments for money in libraries, not just a lot of what I'm going to be saying is applicable to any library, anybody trying to hang on to digital material. There is so much competition for resources, and sometimes when I think about this, I think this is going to, you know, pretty much suck dollars out of everything else for the next 20 years until we figure it out. If I start sounding too grim, it's really just to keep you awake. Yeah? I believe the PowerPoint will be on the News Division's website.
Yes, it will, and we're also recording the presentation of the Revelation podcast to figure out what we're doing.
Oh, my God, my first podcast. Okay. So here's the question. This was actually one of the last questions we asked, but I think it's the answers are really interesting because this was kind of a true confessions. I think another thing going on here is people really want to see, especially those of you in News Division, want to see what everybody else is doing. And so to ask the question, in any of your previous preservation activities, including, we all know the litany, right? Upgrading software, moving to a new storage medium or new software, did you experience any loss of data or metadata or otherwise compromise the archives? I think a lot of people maybe slightly embarrassed to answer this, but it was an anonymous survey, and we got something on there, 28 or 30 people took time to explain what had happened. And the answers are really kind of all over the map, so we're going to share some of them with you. This, by the way, is Chris Hardesty here. This is a page from Newsday that he gave me some years ago that shows, as they were processing through their pagination system, it just sort of dropped out the story at the bottom. They were hoping to automate their page to microfilm process, and it turned out that they couldn't because stuff just sort of disappeared. Here's a first answer. Someone lost about 20% of the stories and photos when they changed systems. The text is still available through the old archive. The photos are believed to be there, but no one has had the time to try to get them back. I see people smiling. This is familiar already. We had a disaster in which a vendor accidentally deleted our entire electronic photo archive. Then we discovered that the IT staffer who set up our tape backups had made an error in programming, rendering the tapes almost useless. The moral of the story is be sure to test. You know how to do statistics? Figure out what a random sample is and do it. We lost all the story indexing for 1987, and we don't know how. This is pretty common. We're not sure why these glitches occurred. We think a previous upgrade in a different archive system might have hidden formatting and caused the problem. I'll probably say this more than once. Anything that we might be doing now, and I'm referring to the newspaper that came out this morning, at any one of 140,000 newspapers, anything that we're doing now, even if we did everything right, may embed some code that later on will cause a file to deteriorate, not be complete, and so on. A software upgrade caused us to lose July of 1997. Why July of 97? And a similar upgrade lost us JPEGs in our photo archive. Now this should stop your heart. Fortunately, they're on CDs. Who thinks that CD is a great archival medium? Oh, good. I used to get a lot of hands when I asked that question. The native software that the graphics were created in has been upgraded so many times that most of these graphics are no longer accessible. Now, for those of you news archivists or news librarians who subscribe to the Knight Ridder Tribune graphics service, you can have some fun, as I did. Go into the database and look at anything from about 1995, 94, 93 in there. And you'll find a lot of corrupt software for sale. This is a graphic still on there. You can download it. You can pay for it. But as you can see, the looks like the drawing part of the graphic is complete, but the fonts have completely corrupted. So you can't read what it is. Any old database where you're keeping vector files, that's a file format that's really fragile. Newspapers have a lot of them. I think, you know, the outside's about 7 years before the stuff goes away. But meanwhile, they're sitting on your servers. You're storing them and backing them up every day. The is another vendor story. When we upgraded to vendor A a few years ago, no one pulled the data for those photos out of vendor B. They just dumped the photos in the new system. Hundreds of photos have no IPTC data. For those of you not in news archives, IPTC is the so-called standard for news photography metadata standard. And it's sort of the genesis for other emerging standards for text and other types of news objects. But as you'll see later on as we get into the marching pies, it's not a very robust standard. At least a year or more of text files had commas and punctuation deleted. Kind of looks like old Roman text, huh? Someone tried to fix the problem, but this resulted in commas and punctuation being put in the wrong places. There's a fix for you. And make no mistake, this is forever. This is now the archive. This is, you can't go back on something like that. This is what's going to sit there for the next 100 years or five, whatever comes first. Much of the early text files are pretty messy. It looks like some of the fields were either lost or concatenated with the text. Now, this sometimes happens when you go from vendor to vendor when they're working in proprietary formats, which most of them do. They have data fields that don't line up in their metadata, and so they say, well, we'll just take this value from this field, and we'll just park it in this other one, and maybe or maybe not the search engine will see it, but we'll try and not do that with real important fields. So it's very critical that you look carefully at how the metadata and how it's mapping and be whether the search engine is going to be able to see it. And the second question doesn't always get asked. Very insignificant number of corrupt files, very little, but honestly, yes. Here's someone who really had to think about whether they were going to admit having a loss. Because it's very painful for a librarian and an archivist to say, yeah, we're trying the best we can, but still kind of going away. Yes, in moving to new archiving systems, a small percentage of files was lost and unreadable. Now, I can make a commentary here about what small percentage means. We're talking about material that is born digital and does not exist in any form but digital. There is no paper version to go back to. There's no film negatives or anything like that. So if you have an archive and you have to migrate it for the next 125 years, which happens to be how far back the LA Times archives go, and you lose a small percentage of files every time you do it, over 125 years, that's a pretty big percentage. If it's 1% each time you do it, very quickly you're talking about thousands of files. And the other question that you should ask is, well, where is it going? And the answer is, it's not going anywhere. It's what I call waxy buildup. It sits on your servers. It sits on your hard drives. Your IT department faithfully backs it up, pays for it. You order new RAID arrays and get the newest, best offline systems or SAN or wherever you're going to put it, but it never goes away because how are you going to identify these files? Anybody know? I don't know. I mean, there's approaches to that, but it's something to keep in mind. Waxy buildup. I'm going to trademark that. Just to keep us awake, treated us from some files from the Los Angeles Times that went away. This was not an answer from an LA. In fact, this was an anonymous survey, so I can't. There's no way to associate who lost what with who filled out the survey. Somebody answered that migrating to the web interface corrupted some files. So that is exactly what happened at the LA Times. We're not sure when, but we ran a series of tests last October, November, where we ran about 300,000 files through a series of JPEG analysis filters. They're free on the web, and you have to have a pretty savvy programmer to do it. But what these filters do is they parse data out of the header of a JPEG file. This is like deep in the guts of JPEG, and who wants to be there? Who wants to talk about it at 7:30 in the morning? But the interesting thing is that when you do that, it will give you a couple of these filters will give you a warning. It'll populate a field with this warning that says extraneous bytes, X 100,000 extraneous bytes at marker 0xd9. And what that means is at some point in the image, it is unable to interpret the byte stream sufficiently, and so what apparently happens is it just drops the data out of the middle of the picture, like this little gray bar here, and then the lower half of it turns color or lightens up or whatever it is. Any IT people in the audience? I had an IT guy give me a lot of pushback when I was speaking at a newspaper recently, and he said, "Well, where does the data go? Where does it go? It's still there. It's bits and bytes." I said, "Bill, you're in IT. You tell me where it goes." I don't know where it goes, but I just know that, you know, somewhere around 1% of the 300,000 or 400,000 files we looked at, around 1% had some kind of problem. I think I've got another example or two in here. So, my favorite answer. Did you lose anything? I don't know. Well, does anybody look? Does anybody look to see if... I don't think this is actual common practice right now, to go in and look and see if stuff is actually deteriorating. And there are ways to do it. The easiest way to do it is just do a statistical sample. And, you know, it may be hiring a college intern, a library school intern for a summer to manually look at 1,000 or 2,000 files out of whatever database it is. We did that at the Times. We hired an intern by the name of Chan Lee, and she spent day after day after day looking at JPEGs out of this one database. The programmer generated a random sample, which popped these file names into a database. She was able to look at them, and what it did was validate the number of corrupt files that we thought we had. We could do real counts because we were seeing this extraneous bytes at 0xd9, so we counted the number of those that we had. It's a really interesting experiment, and I think everybody ought to be doing it once in a while so we don't have the I don't know. So, yeah. Of course, who has time, right?
So what did you find out in that project?
For the Times? Yeah. We put about 1% had mysterious clues, and we don't know why. Because, the LA Times is a big, important, well-resourced newspaper with extremely bright IT people, rigorous quality control, regular data backups, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What we think happened is that somewhere in this change to a web interface, when there's a lot of copying of files, when you're moving from hardware to storage, hardware to storage, hardware, and there's this intensive copying going on, all it takes is a tiny little hiccup, and all it has to do is switch a couple of those ones and zeros that are what we're dealing with here. We're not dealing with pictures. And all of a sudden, it may only take just one byte, but if it's in the wrong place in the data stream, it'll mess up whatever's behind it. I'm not an IT guy. So, and I'm not really sure what causes this. I did some research on the web, and a lot of people keeping JPEGs see this extraneous bytes at 0xd9 error. But nobody's sure what it is. And by the way, this is really funny. If you go to all this effort on older JPEGs, parse out this data, see this error, and then upgrade the pictures to Photoshop in the CS2 suite, it overwrites that field. Fills it, takes away the 0xd9 warning and makes it look like a perfectly good file. So you have to test the heck out of everything, and on top of everything else you do. I'm sorry, it's bad news. Okay, let's look at pies. Everybody need coffee? We'll take a quick coffee break before we get pies. Who responded to the survey? The news library division is mostly newspapers, but it's got broadcasts, it's got radio, it's got people at universities. It's such a great listserv that a lot of people sign up for it. And that's how we promoted the survey, was over the listserv. So it's preponderance is newspapers, and that's what we're concerned with here. But I'll reiterate, the issues here are true of pretty much any digital archive. This just happens to be news. We also asked how archives are used. 100% of you answered that it's done for news research, and that is to serve the newsroom, the reporters, the journalists, the editors, and that is the important thing about that is the overarching goal. Preservation is somewhere down the list. We this is just sort of incidental, also selling stuff to the public and vendors, LexisNexis, Newsbank, Factiva. Some of you let your corporate folks research there. Some of you actually let outsiders use your archives. The preponderance of survey takers were from, I would think, sort of medium-sized newspapers. The numbers were fairly small. I mean, we're talking, I think, in the 8% or so that were big newspapers. There were maybe only 4 or 5 people from papers that size. There aren't that many papers that size in the country. So these are, you know, pretty much mid-range newspapers in every case. Okay, here's the question. To what extent is your senior newsroom management committed to archival policy? This is obviously important because they're going to be signing the capital budget checks. The good news is 33%, were very, or at least somewhat. So at least more than half are kind of paying attention to this, if I can make a loose conclusion. The 21% that are not especially interested or couldn't care less are you sort of want to know what's going to happen to this stuff. We wondered too if there are any job requirements in news libraries, or are you actually going after people with archives backgrounds, news MLISs, MLSs. And I was surprised that almost 2/3 don't have any kind of degree requirement. Many reported even not even a BA. But if someone had extensive experience in news archives, then that would be an overriding consideration. Of the 39% who said that they did require a degree, most of them required a master's in library science or something like that. And the good news, too, I guess for those of you who are here, there is opportunity for continuing education. And let me make a plug for, if you're interested in this area, let me make a plug for the Society of American Archivists, which is meeting in Washington the first part of August. If you want, there's a lot about digital archives at SAA. I've been coming to SLA for many years, and there are finally starting to be some other sessions about digital preservation, but that was not the case a few years ago. Well, SAA is all over this, and so if this is an area that you really want to embrace, and we need people to do that, believe me, investigate SAA. It's another great organization. This is an interesting question. Is any of the archives budget earmarked for preservation? And the 20% who answered yes, I suspect that is not about digital preservation, but is about digitizing your old negatives and old hard copy prints. Is that kind of nod your head? I mean, is anybody actually spending money for digital preservation? Preservation is such a broad term. I mean, IT thinks it means backing it up 3 times a week, and traditional libraries talk about preservation in terms of acid paper and old negatives and mold and things like that. Digital preservation, spending for digital preservation, we didn't drill down deep enough, but I think next time we ask the survey, we'll see if that's really the case. But 70%, there is no budget for preservation, so it's kind of academic.
Vicki, were you able to see if there was any correlation between this slide where there's money earmarked for preservation and the other one where people were concerned about it and the people who sell to vendors and sell, use, make money on
that? You know, we've only really started analyzing this data, and I haven't done that kind of, but I really think that what's driving the preservation budget is not saving stuff, it's making content available for the web. That if you can digitize your old glass negatives, then you will be able to put them online and sell them. That's driving a certain amount of preservation, is my hunch. Somebody, you know, run up and slap me if I'm wrong, but I think that preservation and access get mixed up a lot, and digitization is not equivalent to preservation. You digitize for access. So I think that's what's going on here. But we'll look at the data a little more closely. This is really important. Anybody have a policy for preservation? I'll get a show of hands. Who's got a written policy for preservation in whatever library you've got?
one, too.
Give that man a cup of coffee. That's great. That's fantastic. This is a really, this is a big deal because I have come to the conclusion over the several years I've been doing this that I don't know how you can build a system without having a policy, without determining up front what you're going to keep and what you're not. And the fun thing going on is everybody's keeping everything. If the photo department, the photographers, the world's greatest electronic pack rats, if they want to keep every outtake they ever shot, they go to the library and say, well, we only need 2 terabytes every month. It's really easy. It's just cheap storage. And so you end up with these massive amounts of under-described data. My own sad experience is that news librarians don't really have much say in that discussion. It's, okay, is that what you want? You're paying for it. But a policy would allow you to establish where you're going to point your resources. If you can only have, if you've only got so much money, you can only save so much stuff, you better know pretty clearly what you want to save. And if it's published JPEGs, great. If it's PDFs of information graphics and not the native software, that's really smart. But you're not alone. I was at an SAA session a year or two ago and packed ballroom. I don't think it was 7:30 in the morning, though. Packed ballroom about developing a policy for digital preservation. And it was the same thing. Show of hands, who's got one? And you know, there's been 300 or 400 people in there. 2 people raised their hands. So it's a big deal. It can be done. This is something that Peter and I think about a lot, is how would you write a really good policy? And I think that's, going forward, that's something we're going to be looking at, see if people are starting to pick that up. This goes a little bit into what I was just saying. If you had one, we asked, if you have a policy, does it cover what do you take in? How willing are you to keep formats that are very fragile? And newspapers have quite a few of those. If you're agreeing to take in fragile formats, how long are you promising people you're going to hang on to them? This is all about user expectations, meaning understanding what users are going to need 5, 10, 15, 100 years from now. What kind of computer do they have? Who knows? But you have to identify the characteristics of files that are really going to be important to hang on to. Review for updates of technology. These are papers that said they had a policy. But for those who did, a little over 80% said they do address digital records in their policies. I suspect that the other 20% probably existing policies about photo acquisition that go back to pre-digital archives. If you have no policy, does anybody know what you're doing? I guess this is another way to look at this question. The answer is roughly half don't, you know, there's no policy and we're not really sure. But that's, again, not at all atypical. And only 40% are even planning a policy, but that's good. I think last time I used to ask around, nobody even really realized why it was important. This is a kind of an interesting question, too. I think, can you take preservation action on a file for which you do not have copyright? This is sort of a pop quiz kind of question. They don't know. 60% is actually lower than I thought it might be. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act prohibits you from making electronic copies and taking preservation action against material that you don't have the clear rights to. But with so many automated systems, the material flowing into databases, you know, in hundreds or many hundreds a day, nobody really has the time to sit there and vet each file. So this is just a little illegal activity going on in our archives. But, you know, I thank God it is. Where else is this stuff going to go? Some freelancer's hard disk, and then it's lost to the world. So This is a total side issue, but there is some effort to try to allow different types of libraries to retain orphan works and copyrighted material for preservation purposes. News libraries are not among them because most of they're all from for-profit, well, except for NPR, right? For-profit organizations. But Peter and I attended a hearing in March, and we think made a valiant argument that news libraries ought to at least be considered in Section 108 as repositories of really important information, even if they are for-profits. We were interested in the newspapers have kept text electronically for many, many years, back to the late 70s, early 80s in some cases. And you may be interested to know that newspapers have some of the oldest digital image files in the world. They were really the first industry to adopt digital workflows, and a lot of the rest of the world is coming around to digital asset management systems and understanding how you keep photos for a long time. But newspapers have quite a history with digital images already. Going back, I think the original was probably the AP Leaf Desk in the late 1980s, is the first digital asset management system. But there's all this other stuff now that is coming down the pipeline in the news libraries. And so we said, is anybody keeping video? 15% said yes, they are starting to keep web video because more and more photographers are shooting video instead of still or in addition to still photography. And a lot of reporters are shooting video too. The renowned Converged Newsroom, which is the model in so many academic journalism programs, is really starting to happen. So it's yet another form of content. 90% of you are keeping graphics. And graphics are, as you saw with that Knight Ridder stuff, some of the most fragile, difficult to save content. No best practices models showing up yet. And I'll talk about best practices towards the end. Only 20% are hanging on to web pages. And that is, of mounting interest because the New York Times announced their web page is their edition of record now. So we can assume that they're going to archive it. But this is, more and more, I don't even want to say valuable content, but very important content that right now is, probably sitting on a server and you can't find it unless you've got the URL, but obviously not archived or cataloged in any strategic way. We thought that, text and photos are one thing, but what else are news librarians being asked to archive? Text in proprietary format. That you're keeping Word documents, you're keeping WordPerfect, files in a proprietary database that isn't compatible with Word or a flat standard like ASCII. Are you keeping images other than JPEGs and TIFFs? Those are two fairly robust standards, but almost half are keeping images in some other format. Maybe I should speak for a second about the importance of standards. If you're keeping stuff in a standard format, the likelihood is somebody will come along later and write a migration path for it. But if you're keeping in some material in a homegrown format or homegrown plus vendor plus newsroom tech guy, cobbled together, baling wire format, that's just really seriously at risk because, I'll tell you a little horror story about a paper that I know of, and I hope the librarian isn't here. They had a homegrown system, a small paper, they had a homegrown system migrated to an out-of-the-box text and photo archive, and then for budgetary reasons, skipped a major upgrade. The vendor, which was a small regional vendor, went out of business. The company that bought it was unable to parse any of the code that this paper had all its content in because it was an old version that they just did not have any records for. It gets worse, so they lost everything. There were two newsroom tech guys who really understood the systems. One of them quit, moved far, far away, and the other was killed in a car accident. So, you know, how many things are wrong with this scenario? You've got no standard, two really crucial single point failures, vendors with an untried track record. I mean, it's just tragic. And so the librarian told me that they tried for a year to everything they could think of to try and pry this content out of these old formats, these old databases, and they finally threw in the towel. 10 years worth of pictures and 15 years worth of tests. But they have microfilm, right? Thank God for microfilm. Okay. So that's my little. My great grandfather was a preacher, an evangelist. So you know, give me a microphone. We're also keeping spreadsheets. We're keeping GIS databases. Hell, that's kind of fun to archive. I think there's only one that everybody talks about, ArcView. That's one of the most closely held, secretive companies out there. Wonderful stuff, but a lot of GIS stuff showing up in the databases. And then specialized databases that develop out of computer-aided reporting projects, FileMaker Pro, Access Cold Fusion, stuff like that. If the newsroom creates it, they want to keep it. I like that. Okay, let's talk about standards. What's so funny?
Fear.
I would propose that you probably want to know the answer to this. Unfortunately, the news business is not richly endowed with standards the way libraries are, with MARC and Dublin Core and Ferber and AACR2 and after AACR2 and all the rest of it. The good news is a little over half are using a metadata standard, and it's probably IPTC or some flavor thereof. IPTC, for those of you non-news folks, was developed by the International Press Telecommunications Committee, and it began as a standard to transmit wire stories around the world. You know, probably with its antecedents in the Civil War or something like that. But I don't know. It's a pretty old standard. And it has grown and morphed, and it's still very, very much about pictures. But you can see the influence of IPTC in the Photoshop header because, you know, there was a lot of collaboration on that software. Newspapers were one of the really early users of Photoshop. So IPT is out there. There's a lot of effort to, there's a text format, NITF, developed by the same people. There's an envelope for it, NewsML, which is an XML envelope for news content. It's happening. Unfortunately, from where I sit, it doesn't include anything like preservation metadata, technical metadata. Because it's XML, you can nest all that stuff. But it's still, as standards go, very subject to customization for local use. I mean, you got to get the darn paper out at night. So you map those fields, whatever you need to do to get the paper out. And then hopefully, you know, vendors do things to IPTC also, that what one paper uses for a particular, to populate a certain field, another paper may use it for something else. And then there's the ever popular special instructions field, which has everything else in it. It's like miscellaneous, the bane to every librarian, miscellaneous field. The smart answer, we saw many variations on this, is we add or subtract as needed, but we try to keep the fields at least similar so that when we do map them to the next system, they'll more or less line up. And I think that's pretty, everybody knows kind of intuitively that's what you need to do. Anyway, the end of the day, it's not a very robust standard, but it's all we've got. This cracked me up. Are you using a corporate standard for metadata? Now, who is very familiar with the term content sharing in the chain? We want to share content. We want to give the other properties our stuff. We want to be able to send stuff back and forth seamlessly. In the library world, it's called interoperability. The only way you can do that is if everybody's pretty much on the same page metadata-wise, and only 12% said yes, they've got a corporate standard. I sat on a corporate standards committee. We thought we'd accomplish in about 4 days. And it usually takes a good 6 months to get, minimally, to get people to agree on the basics of a metadata standard. I friends at Disney that are, you know, 2 or 3 years into corporate metadata. You know, they've got one, but they keep adding to it, and everybody's got something they need to do, and all those pesky standards. We asked what's in your metadata, because that's very important to digital preservation. These are, to me, if you were going to boil down preservation metadata, these are the big, what do we have here, the big seven. Right, if you don't have the rights information, you end up not knowing which is how you can preserve it, whether you can preserve it. And thanks to the Ticini decision, and I don't know if the non-news folks are familiar with Ticini, but it was, you know, like Hurricane Katrina in news databases. Newspapers spent months and years trying to identify who their freelance creators were in the absence of any metadata about it. Unique identifier is kind of interesting. I mean, that's the that's absolutely core to a preservation system, because you can't ever overwrite or duplicate a number or an identifier in the next 2,000 years or 150 or 5, whatever you're going to do with your digital archives. For the 40% or so who don't have unique identifiers, you kind of wonder what's going to happen. But software name, software version, and hardware requirements are really important. If you're going to try to render this stuff later, you have to leave a queue for some future programmer or user to know what kind of, oh, do I have to get an old Macintosh out of the basement that runs OS 8 so I can run this freehand 3 file? If that's not embedded in there somewhere, you're greatly shortening the life of the program. What is it? You know, what the heck is it? That's part of that waxy buildup problem. Operating system requirements, or even if it's a big difference between OS 10 and OS 9 for those in the Mac world, we saw all kinds of anomalies migrating between those two. And they would show up in the oddest places, like in the Sun server software caused some collisions. I mean, totally unanticipated. And then peripherals for rendering. This goes back to what I was saying about having to understand what users 100 years from now are going to be needing. Okay, who's responsible for this? There's a lot of... They are? Me? Oh, God, no. typically, it's IT. And the bulletin here is IT does not worry about preservation. They absolutely think, well, there's a few who get it, but they absolutely think that preservation is, yes, by God, we back it up. 6 ways from Sunday and 60 miles away and everything else. I thought the hardware is way over the top for archives to be taking on with everything else they have to do. But software is different, because those are the actual users. And so once again, though, the users have kind of surrendered this to their IT departments. Other is a big chunk at 28%, and that's vendors, the photo department itself, and the newsroom. I sense that what sometimes happens is librarians who are overwhelmed with everything else they have to do will say to the photo department, okay, you guys worry about it yourselves. Over to you. And I think, didn't one of those answers to the, how do you do this question? Somebody answered, the photographers don't want us to put publication information in our pictures. We don't want to mess it up with pub date and page number, so we don't do that anymore. So, big picture here is librarians, you guys, have to step in and start taking responsibility for this, because no one else will. That's that's the short answer. No one else will do it. Speaking of vendors, are you working with a vendor on preservation? Again, I wonder what I meant here by preservation and what the survey takers meant by preservation. There's a project that I'm working on with the Center for Research Libraries that CRL and the Research Libraries Group are developing a set of criteria for what a long-term preservation system is. What do you really have to do? Because there are certain, not in news, but just in the library world in general, there are vendors who will say, we are building preservation systems. But really anybody can say that. What does it mean to build a preservation system? So CRL asked me, because I've done work in news, to specify what criteria you would need to build a long-term news repository. And one of the one of the things that I think is really interesting and very difficult to do is if you've got existing indexing, if you've got good manual subject indexing on your databases, shouldn't that be retained? And how does that map to the old microfilm? If you've digitized that, is there any subject access to old microfilm? I mean, there's all these issues. Because we're not talking about plain old microfilming. This is all becoming of interest because there are a number of newspapers all over the world that just simply don't want to do microfilming anymore, which is a very scary thing, but it's expensive and they're under-resourced. And what seems to be happening is some papers will say, well, it's in LexisNexis. I can't do this myself, so we'll just hand it over to LexisNexis. And so you see the emergence of some of the database vendors as the de facto archives. But are they really archival systems? They didn't sign up for that. So in the next few years, I think we'll be seeing some actual criteria against which you can measure a vendor for a preservation system. Although we're, you know, certainly not there yet. I'm still writing, so. We're getting near the end. Anybody, you know, want to stand up and? Okay. How knowledgeable is your staff? I like the people who answered zero, because you know, these are honest. This is one of those benchmark type questions that, you know, we're what do we have here? About 18% who really think that they've got either very high or moderate knowledge of everything we're talking about this morning. And the rest of them have a certain amount of catching up to do. But once more, if the libraries are the ones that are beginning to be taking responsibility for this, we are looking for 100% with high knowledge. So next time we ask this question, we'll hope that little tiny red pie slice there gets a little wider. We asked people what they thought the most pressing issues in digital preservation are right now. And I think that, you know, everybody's congregating around the same sorts of answers. Finding good solutions. Well, right now there aren't any that you can go out and buy. Arriving at standards, keeping up with the technology. Getting accurate technology that makes the content completely searchable, readable, and printable in the future. Accurate technology is sort of a wonderful phrase. It's when I worked on the CCI rollout at the Times, it quickly became abundant that it was such a vast system that there was no single person who understood all of it. No, and we called it the big head, the missing big head. And you see this in ever more complicated systems, is that people have their corners of of knowledge about a system, but the one person with the big picture is just not there. And so how do you build an accurate system by getting people together who have all this knowledge to communicate regularly? It really takes a lot of collaboration, what we're talking about. Most pressing issue, CD rot. For those of you who consigned your entire photo database to CDs, yep, that's true. If you have CDs, just a quick helpful hint, if you've got CDs that are several years old, you might consider at least putting them on newer CDs because in the last 2 or 3 years, I think there's a new NISO standard for long-term CDs. And before, any CD manufacturer could say, oh, this will last for 1,000 years. And, you know, they would say things like that. This is a forever medium. And I think it was NPR said that they had some, Rob Robinson said they were like 100 years CDs, and after five they delaminated. So if you got old crappy CDs, sorry, don't use words like that. If you got bad old CDs, get them on a new, better CDs. CDs are only the you know, smallest of the stopgap, because as soon as DVDs hit the market, CDs became obsolete. It's just a matter of getting them out of the system. So, you know, be thinking about that if you don't have a database.
I got some news on that issue. NIST has done some study on it, and the average is about 10 years for the regular CDs. They're coming out with a new CD with the manufacturer OSTA as the optical technology group, and they said they're going to be about 50-year CDs. Guaranteed.
Okay, can anybody answer the question why we don't care about 50-year CDs? Because you will never find a computer that will be able to interpret the data. You know, CDs for, I swear archaeologists will be digging up silver discs, you know, 1,000 years from now.
They all
have AOL to replace them. They'll write the
AOL 7.
Right. Getting the resources, of course, a big deal. You know, in the depressing landscape of news libraries now. Industry-wide best practices. Well, that's just what this survey was all about, to see if there are any starting to show up, at least among the practitioners doing it. This speaks to what's going on. This speaks to the difference between access and preservation. The most pressing issue is getting material into digital formats. We are not thinking about the preservation issues after. This is all about digitizing your back files so you can sell them on the web. And a lot of librarians and vendors and bosses and capital budget writers think that, well, gee, it's digital now. It's good for the long haul. And all you've really done is set up another preservation problem. So if you're digitizing your glass negs and your back files or anything like that, have a plan for what you're going to do with them afterwards. You certainly don't want to digitize stuff and then throw away the original, at least not until there's real preservation systems. Then you might feel more comfortable doing that. But if anybody's saying, oh, well, let's digitize the heck out of this and we'll throw it away and then we'll have a lot of extra space, know what you're throwing away and be ready to pay for what you're replacing it with, because it's in the end, I think, still cheaper to keep it in paper format, especially if you're a small organization. I'm afraid that once I finally have all the metadata procedures in place, current software, all the work could be lost with a mistake when it's updated in the future. Some of you have seen me speak before, have seen this little logo. This was this is what happens to software over time. See how the background is degrading? And see how this is what successive migrations in a very compressed time frame, because it's a vector file format. This is what happens when a newer version isn't interpreted 100%. A newer version of software doesn't interpret an old file 100%. It does it the best it can, but over two generations, it's having more. I'm sort of anthropomorphizing the software here, but is having more and more trouble rendering those backgrounds. And so you get this plaid thing going on. And so even if you're sustaining files and they appear as legitimate files and you can open them, they may not be 100% valid. And so once again, this is why you want to look at batch files. And if you have a format that's fairly fragile like vector software, you maybe you want to think about making a PDF of it after a certain number of years and just throwing the original away. It's just too expensive, too hard to do, and the return isn't really worth it if it's going to do stuff like this. This actually came up when we were migrating to from one pagination system to another, and we had to recreate a bunch of logos for publication. And this was a couple versions of. It started out as an Illustrator file, and then went through freehand, and then it came out back in Illustrator. But that's one of my favorite examples. You know, the nice thing about news archives is we actually have examples of digital stuff going away that we can actually show. A lot of it's still theoretical for people. Okay, the whole point of this was best practice, so I thought I'd go over quickly what looks like on the horizon, at least, positive developments for long-term preservation. We do have a standard. We're not totally without it. And I think that some focused activity on getting IPTC a little more robust would go a long way towards helping us out. There's growing awareness. I mean, I've been giving this talk one way or the other in some flavor for about 6 years. And more and more people nod when I say things instead of looking shocked. So I think people are starting to pick up. There seems to be a lot of availability of continuing education opportunities. I think it's wonderful that the papers are still spending money to send people to SLA and everybody else. So exploit that as much as you can. Join SAA if you're really interested in this. Metadata is no longer a word that makes people's heads explode. So I think that's a positive development, because really this is going to be all about metadata. There's a whole suite of preservation metadata that is even now in implementation mode at a couple of places. And if that can be folded somehow into IPTC and systems built around automatically capturing platform and software information, that will also go a long way towards giving us good records for the long haul. And thanks to Ticini, we are so on top of rights management. Nothing like a disaster to really, give you religion. These are some of the areas that I think need work. Let's try to get a handle on what we're losing. In fact, I was going to suggest that if you have a little tale of loss, email me, and I'll maybe, start a blog or something. I think it would be useful. One of the things that I've heard many people say is, well, yeah, we're losing stuff, but nobody notices it, so nobody's really going to pay attention to it until we have a really big disaster. And I think if there's some way to have a compendium of stuff going away, then maybe it'll get people's attention. You know, when some newspaper loses half of its photo archive, I think that's kind of important. And we shouldn't feel sad or embarrassed. We should reach out to each other and say, help these people. Format control. There's no law that says you have to take in every format that the newsroom or your users, if you're not in the news business. There's no reason that you have to take in every format that somebody wants to keep. There are some really great models. I suggest you look at DSpace, which is the domain of academic libraries, and developed by MIT and Hewlett-Packard. And it allows you to do sort of a strategized format control, and it builds a system that will choke if it sees a format it doesn't like. And then if you absolutely have to keep a non-standard or difficult format, then in a certain number of years you make the decision that you're going to do something else with it to give it more of a long-term thing. Or you can decide, well, we'll just keep this waxy buildup against the day that somebody figures out how to get at it. That's also a legitimate strategy, but it's the kind of thing you want to know going in, which of course speaks to the policy issue. It would be excellent if you decide these things up front. Yes, we're going to keep this. No, we're not going to keep that. After 5 years, we will make a PDF out of it. We will give up on it entirely after 10. Or we will keep the ones and zeros, if that's what they are, forever and ever, just so long as everybody knows and knows what they're signing on for. Resources are scarce. I mean, everybody's watching this, the evolution of the advertising-supported news model is going up in smoke, and the web is replacing it, and there's so much free information out there. What's going to happen? Well, nobody knows, but obviously it has bearing on how all of this will be funded. And God knows I know what the answer is, but it's something that we'll be watching. I've mentioned this several times. What is preservation? Just, you know, preservation is not digitization, and it is not backing it up overnight. It is taking the steps to maintain at least the intellectual content that you've got. If not the original, if not the look and feel of the original, at least the intellectual content. And what resources there are for preservation seems to be going for retrospective digitization, which is fine, but again, this is all about making money and access. So we're going to be looking at, we're hoping the next survey will be in a, you know, maybe 18 months. I'm watching to see if the vendors are going to start picking up on this, and if they're going to start thinking about, if you ask for it, they'll start thinking about it. You know, if you're looking at a big image database upgrade, say, let's start talking about digital preservation, and then see what they say. Are we going to start seeing preservation metadata beginning to enter into these systems? Are we going to start capturing hardware, software, peripherals, operating system, and that kind of data? Are we going to start writing policies towards building these systems? Are we going to draw the line in the carpeting about what we are going to ingest? I think we undoubtedly will see some more tales of loss before we get any better. I sat through a session the other day with Georgia Higley here on the National Digital Newspaper Project at the Library of Congress, and it actually made me feel better, because as long as we're still making microfilm, years from now we can scan the darn microfilm and put it into that system. So it seems kind of hilarious that we're doing all these fabulous digital workflows and have a lot of track record in it, but in the end, it's still just microfilm. So on that note, don't stop making it. Microfilm's your friend. Okay, we've got, and I just want to show you, here's my favorite JPEG. Several things wrong with this one. It rearranged the pieces, it dropped data out, it changed the color. It's like somebody took scissors and painted it. Isn't that great? Wonderful picture. It's a bunch of young actresses at one of the universities doing Midsummer Night's Dream. Isn't that great? But that's a really old file. Oh my God, that's 1998. That's so last millennium, you know. So we love talking about this. As Chris mentioned last night, I really do lie awake worrying about this. I thought it was getting better, but no.
Yeah, you did last night.
Last night. Well, so there's our email contacts. This will go up on NewsLib's News Division's website. I've got cards. I'll stick around for questions, or we can take questions from the floor. Anybody want to? Yeah.
I just want to make a comment. I'm not a news librarian, but my organization has decided to do something about preservation, and we're setting up our own system. And some of the things you said are exactly what we looked at. We decided that we had to pick one format, that whatever's going into the archive gets translated into that format and that format only. And we may keep a native format as a secondary, but the archive is the format that we translate it into. It's the only way you're going to be able to translate further down the line is to have everything standardized.
Yeah, there's use. It's almost like in classic preservation, there's use copies, which might be your native software, and then there's your archival copy, which is there for the long term, and you don't do anything to it. Now, that lovely picture of the girls in the face paint, I mean, that was the archival JPEG. And the funny thing is about that, this is a robustly backed up system. What happened? We backed up the bad file. That's because most systems don't do bit level. It was phenomenally hard and expensive and time consuming to do, but if you don't do bit level validation, you can't spot a mistake in the file. The file still looks like a file, and the way these systems typically work is they'll count the number of JPEGs. Okay, we've got 300,000 JPEGs in, 300,000 JPEGs out. Copy, copy, copy. New database, everything's good. Well, if three or four of them are corrupt, they have overwritten the good file, so you have no good file to go back to. That's the really scary thing about digital archives, is that, you know, you have to you really have to be looking at files all the time, or you'll overwrite everything in a backup. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to, for people who are interested in looking at the kind of research that's going on in digital preservation, I just wanted to put in a plug for the Library of Congress's website, the National Digital Information Infrastructure Protection Program, or NDIP, as we call it. There's a lot of work being done with partners all across the United States who are working on various strategies for digital preservation, metadata standards, being able to transfer data, and if you're interested, just go to the library's website and you'll get what's going on as we speak. And there is some wonderful work there. California libraries, math libraries in North Carolina with GIS material. So there's a whole variety of things, and you might find something that will help your thinking about it.
Some Library of Congress operating plan? No, because we don't know the solutions yet.
We're experimenting. It's kind of like, to me, the image is throwing the spaghetti against the wall and seeing what's going to stick. Lots of different people with trying out different strategies and then coming back together and sharing and collaborating.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Is that there's no solution you can go buy out of a box, and any vendor who tells you that they've got one is hopeful. Well, I ran through a long list of words. But that does not.
That may be well meaning.
Yeah, very well meaning. But that doesn't mean that there aren't things that you can do right now that will at least get you sort of in the mindset to do it right when there are solutions and set you up for a fighting chance at preserving some of this stuff. I am convinced that we have lost the 1990s. They're gone. They're sitting on hard disks, but they're heading for waxy buildup. And we'll hit 2010 and probably have not done much better in the O's. But there are things you can do. Capture format, capture operating system, capture software version, normalize your files. Don't mess around with JPEG. IPTC. Save TIFFs instead of JPEGs. That's axiomatic, but everybody keeps JPEGs because, when we started out on this, storage was real expensive. So there's things you can do now. Yeah.
What do you see as trends in storage? The disks are stopgap and the server farms mean constant migration, but do you see any storage trends that are hopeful?
Well, the important thing about digital preservation and preservation metadata, and I'm really used to early in the morning. I was on the premise committee that Library of Congress and OCLC had for a year and a half trying to develop preservation metadata. And if you go to the premise, just Google premise, PREMIS, there's some actual examples. I did an information graphic. I cataloged it in premise just to see if it could be done. And it's that leading criteria is that it has to be platform independent. You cannot attach it to. You have to anticipate that anything that is true now will not be true in 5 years. And any, who knows, we'll have buckyball storage or something. You just cannot anticipate what it's going to be. I thought zip disks were the greatest thing, since night baseball, and then I got, Mr. Flash Stick. And any new technology that comes out that is better than X is there to obsolete X. That's why it's there. And you have this entire business model in Silicon Valley, which is every 18 months, it's got to be better, faster, more expensive, denser data, new features. And that is great for Silicon Valley, and it drives the tech engine in the world, but it really sets up the preservation problem because it's a constantly moving target. And I was at a conference, I'm sure some of you have heard me say this before, I was at a conference where there was an IBM guy, and he says, we hate standards, we will never use them, we don't like them, and they complicate what we do, and they keep us from delivering good products, so, up standards. And if you look what's going on in the state of Massachusetts, I think one of the states is actually sort of back in Microsoft space saying, we're not using Word anymore. It's got to be open source or forget it. And they've been duking it out. I think Massachusetts won. I don't know if anybody's been watching that. So, you know, there's things you can do now. And, you know, look into open source. You're right, there's a ton of stuff on the web about preservation. It's changing so quickly you almost can't, don't bother looking at journal articles and magazines. It's all on the web. DLIB magazine, D-L-I-B, terrific resource for articles. And it comes out, I don't know, a month or so. Really good resource and well written.
You had a question over there.
Yeah. Georgia.
Just to follow up on the question about possible training and all, while the Library of Congress doesn't have training classes on things, I think our documentation is really robust. I mean, I know for the National Digital Newspaper Program, the documentation that the LC participation and of the six awardees' documentation is all up there. That's been put out to date. And the other thing associated with those awardees is that they're all experienced digitizing and preservation sites. And for instance, the University of Utah offers a workshop every, I think, 3 to 6 months on how you go about digitizing material and what you have to keep in mind for that. And I think there are a lot of libraries that do have strong digital programs that have this kind of workshop. So you might want to just check around almost in your backyard, so to speak, and see what's available, because it's probably there.
Yeah. Eli?
I probably didn't hear it by working at the Internet Archive, so this question is completely out of bounds. Just laughing. I'm wondering if it's possible to multitask on the issue of preservation. I mean, obviously, we want best practices. We want as much metadata as possible. We want the highest standards, the most robust formats. But I'm wondering if we should also think about last resorts, sort of having lowest common denominator formats, keeping text in ASCII, you know, finding just most flexible, easiest to render graphics format, and just keeping it in a sort of DIMM archive just in case something happens.
Well, I think that's pretty much what normalization is about, is that it's picking a handful of easy to migrate formats that, well, like PDFA, the archival PDF, was created and conceptualized as being a long-term format that everybody is signing on and swearing they will not mess around with it. So, yeah, if it's maybe a little better than ASCII if you have appearance issues, if you want to see what that font looked like, if you want to retain the look of a logo of a newspaper, for instance, that all goes away in ASCII, but it doesn't in PDF. And so there are equivalent flatline formats. I think I just coined a word. You know, these no-mind formats that do have... There are resources being pointed at keeping things like that. And so my bitter experience with graphics is that we built a database at the Times that is full of old software that you can't, that is not, it's like Knight Ridder. It's not renderable. You don't want it. There's no way to get rid of it. And
all I do was laugh at
that thing. Oh, I know. Oh, and I was so proud of it about 10 years ago. But graphics are something that it's, you even have to look at how much easier it would be for the artist to recreate something from scratch than it is to try to keep this alive. It's a no-brainer equation. Keep it for 5 years and then obsolete it. But you have to build a system that'll do that, so you don't have to go looking for all the old stuff file by file. You just, you know. So does that answer your question? Yeah, you look for those formats. ASCII may be one of them. I mean, this is why, like, LexisNexis, NewsBank, Factiva are actually pretty good long-term repositories. They have a very narrow platform. They are not subject to somebody else's software whim. or somebody else's upgrades. They do it all internally. It's theirs, and they never throw anything away unless somebody asks them to.
NPR has transcripts going back to 1990, and they've been available through Nexus and other vendors. A couple years ago, when we were renegotiating that contract, they only wanted the archive from 95 forward because they perceived no demand for such old material. So I'm sure you're right, they wouldn't have thrown it away, but it wouldn't have been available.
Yeah, well, that...
The key is more.
Oh, I know I'd say something inflammatory. Well,
sometimes we all don't send them all of our stories, but no. Sometimes they don't put all of our stories there.
Well, they could look twice.
Or they look twice. The ones that are missing, they're gone.
And no brackets, of course.
Hmm. Well, right. But see, these organizations have never said they're archival repositories.
Right.
They are not they're for-profit institutions. And, you know, you tell me what the ROI is on an old map of Iraq. This is what's going to be very complicated about this. Who's going to pay for it? Because, publishers want, if they're going to spend a lot of money on a preservation system, they're going to, well, what are we preserving and why? Can't we just throw it away because nobody wants it anyway? But if you're looking at the era where there is no microfilm, that opens up a whole raft of issues about what is the published edition? Is a file authentic? Right now, if somebody sues a paper over something they wrote, they will go and get the microfilm and get it notarized or whatever, and say, this is the juridical copy of this content. If you don't have that, then what is it? And how have you denoted that in the database? I mean, these are all questions that... Join me in lying awake at night. I mean, come on over. We'll have coffee.
You have a question over here.
Yeah. Right.
And then I have a question about what you think about the future of PDF. There are those of us out there who are not motivated by for profit, but digitizing and preserving digital information from the government. And there's whole issues about transferring things to electronic format. PDF has become a default standard, but what do you see as the future for PDF?
Well, if I knew that, Adobe could come to me and, give me flowers and bottles of champagne. I think Adobe in contributing to the PDFA it has its heart in the right place. And I wasn't involved in that, and I only kind of know about it peripherally. But there was a lot of effort to fend off special interest groups that wanted to add features that they thought over long haul would be unsustainable. So, as long as there's sort of an institutional commitment to PDFA, a market, if you will, then it'll be there. But you can't predict the future of technology. All you can really say is whatever's the case now will not be the case later on. And so that's why metadata standards and context and content and all those sorts of things have to be unhitched from any format consideration. Now, PDF, the way I've thought about this for several years is that even though JPEGs are considered to be not archival media because they're you lose data in the compression algorithm, they're so ubiquitous that there will be a critical mass of programmers that will write migration paths for JPEGs that will carry it over to the next whatever it is. I think the same is probably true of PDF, that it's a critical standard and that there will be a lot of people writing migration paths, and vendors will pay attention to it, and this will go on in perpetuity. And PDF, as we know, it may disappear, but that data somehow will survive in some form. We hope all of it, every bit, goes into whatever the future platform is. The more problematic stuff, or the one-offs and the quirky formats, or the feature-laden formats that are very hard to sustain over time. It's not in Microsoft's interest to make software reverse compatible forever. I mean, why upgrade then, you know? So you're fighting a very powerful commercial interest in not making this stuff standard. So, you know, this is sort of the great menace of digital archives, is that you can never stop, you can never rest. You can never shove it in a drawer and go away and die, and somebody else comes along later and finds it, you know. So your institution has to be prepared. You have to be Library of Congress. Your institution has to be prepared to do this. This is your mission, and you can never stop. And you have to have such a firm infrastructure that it's independent of who's doing it. You leave, somebody else comes, and they know what to do. And that's, yeah, it's very hard to do. And we're new at this. We've only been 25 years of digital archives. It's ancient history. So come back in 100 years. Well, Justin.
Never.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Oh.
I'm converted.
Hallelujah.
All formats. May I do a quick one-question survey? Given the number of people here this early in the morning, I'm assuming there's interest in a program, follow the program on next year's?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's going to be at 7 next year.
I'm not kidding. We'll be at 7.
Bring breakfast.
I'll be outside at the break. If you have interest in a particular aspect or tweet or, you know, grab me outside.
Okay. And you had a question?
Yeah.
Another? Okay. Well, it's right at 9 o'clock. I'm going back to bed.
Thanks very much.
Science librarian at the University of Notre Dame, and I don't know how useful this sort of thing is going to be to you, but in the science community or in the library community, there's this software called LOS.
Oh yeah,
LOS.
Yes.
Thank you. I don't know if it would be useful. I don't know how well it looks at you, the kinds of problems that
you have. How much are you saying?
You've got all this stuff going on.
What the FDA and the library were.